Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate News Talk 1010 In-Depth Radio. So great to be here. And if you weren't here, well, it would be awfully lonely in my little studio. Say, if you enjoy Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant and you like Nicolas Cage and the National Treasure, or National Treasure, rather, I'm pretty confident you're going to really, really enjoy the first half of tonight's transmission. David Brody is an attorney and the author of a series of books, I think it's now 9 and counting, on the Knights Templar in America. And his latest, while a work of fiction, is firmly rooted in history. It involves a stolen medieval painting, hidden Templar treasure, including the most important artifacts in Christianity, namely the Holy Grail, the one true cross, the crown of thorns, and the spear of destiny, which was used by a Roman soldier to pierce the side of Jesus Christ during his crucifixion. It also involves Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and their quest to find this hidden Templar treasure. Wow, this ought to be real good. That's coming up. Now, in the second half, this past summer, I was on a beach in southern Greece. Suddenly, my phone rang. Someone was calling me through my Skype handle. Check out the miracle molecule C60. That was all they said. And then the line went dead. That doesn't happen very often. Then I sort of forgot about it. And over the last couple of weeks, suddenly I remembered that strange phone call. I started looking into it. It turns out that back in 1996, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry to three professors: Robert Curl, Rice University; Sir Harold Kroto, University of Sussex, Brighton, England; Richard E. Smalley, Rice University. They were awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery of carbon atoms bound in the form of a ball, clusters of 60 carbon atoms, C60. It's a tiny molecule composed, again, of 60 carbon atoms arranged in a sphere, also known as a buckyball. It's an exceptionally stable molecule, not easily dissolved in water or other solvents. The spherical shape can trap other atoms inside them. They can act as a superconductor. They have been shown to behave as both a wave and a particle, according to quantum physics. Buckyballs have also been shown to bounce, even when fired into stainless steel walls at more than 24,000 kilometers per hour. C60 molecules also return to their original shape when squeezed, and they can also spin at incredibly high speeds, even at room temperature. They can withstand high temperatures and pressures, and the carbon-60 molecules can react with other atoms while preserving their spherical shape. Well, so what, you say? Well, it has tremendous military applications. But, quite by accident, someone also discovered C60 has, apparently, remarkable health benefits when orally ingested. C60, the miracle molecule. Chris Burrows is an engineer and owner of SES Research, and he'll be along in the second half. Of course, we'll carve out some time for your comments and questions and some eclectic bumper music, and you've got another great night of late-night talk radio. Dave Brody is next to talk about a stolen medieval painting and Hitler's quest for the Holy Grail. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather round the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? In Dave Brody's latest Templars in America book, historians Cameron Thorne and Amanda Spencer Gunn uncover a stolen painting, which the Nazis believe was a secret map to the Holy Grail and the lost treasure of the Knights Templar. Hitler planned to weaponize the Holy Grail and monetize the treasure as part of his campaign of world dominance. Cam and Amanda just want to find the legendary artifacts. The Nazis failed because they were unable to decipher the secret Templar clues left in the painting. And Cam and Amanda may fail, perhaps fatally, because a group of modern-day Nazis remain obsessed with finishing Hitler's work. Well, that's the premise in a nutshell of Mr. Brody's latest installment of his Templars in America series, Treasure Templare. It's a wild ride, folks, and he's here with us tonight for the next 2 hours. Mr. Brody is a leading researcher and lecturer in the field of the history of America before Columbus. He's a former director of the New England Antiquities Research Association. He's appeared frequently as a guest expert on documentaries airing on History Channel, Travel Channel, PBS, and Discovery Channel. He's the author of, I think it's 9 and counting historical fiction novels. He's a graduate of Tufts University and Georgetown Law School. And again, his latest is Treasure Templare, Templars, Nazis, and the Holy Grail. David Brody, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me tonight.
So let's start off with a rather important definition, the Knights Templar. Who were they?
They were basically the army of the medieval church from the early parts of the 1100s to the early parts of the 1300s. And they became probably the most powerful force in all of Europe during that time period. They acquired amazing amounts of wealth. They're, as I said, the army of the church. They fought in the Crusades. They were gifted a lot of land by nobility. Something that they discovered in Jerusalem when they were over in the Middle East made them incredibly powerful. We're not quite sure what that was, some kind of treasure or secret. And then just as quickly, they were outlawed by the church, and that's a whole other story. We'll get to that, I'm sure, as we go along.
Right. So the theory is that perhaps, allegedly, they discovered vast fortunes, gold and other treasures beneath the remnants of Solomon's temple. Is that the idea?
It could have been gold. Yes, that's the idea. They discovered something. There were 9 knights went over there, and then almost instantly they came back to Europe and became incredibly powerful. So, I mean, that's one of the questions that no one really knows the answer to. What did they find when they were excavating under King Solomon's temple? Was it gold and silver and treasure? Possibly. Was it ancient secrets of Christianity that the church didn't want to be revealed, and so the Templar Knights used that to leverage themselves into a position of power? Did they find religious artifacts such as the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant? Did they find ancient knowledge that had been lost during the Dark Ages? I mean, it could be any one of those things. But whatever it was, something made them incredibly powerful. And so that's question one. The question two is, what happened 200 years later? They were butting heads with the church over something that they learned or something that they did, and the church cut them down. So what was that second? What caused that? That's mystery number two. And then, of course, mystery number three is this treasure that they had, what happened to it? And those are the three questions that I delve into in this series of books.
Right. And just as a quick aside, didn't the Templars, because of their gold holdings, didn't they really, aren't they credited with starting the banking system as we know it?
Yes, basically, they came up with a system whereby travelers in medieval times, of course, traveling was very, very dangerous and very difficult. Travelers could basically buy what we now call traveler's checks. They could deposit their money, say, in Paris at a Templar headquarters, and were given a coded chit in return, and then they could turn that chit in when they got to Jerusalem or Madrid or wherever they happened to be traveling, Rome, wherever they were going, and turn that in and cash it in. And that allowed them to travel without having to carry gold, cash, with them. And so that was sort of the beginning of the banking system. And from that, the Templars became lenders, financiers, really a multinational corporation. As I said earlier, they became incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful.
And this is, by my count, I believe you're 9th in this series on Templars in America. Do I have that right?
You are correct, yes.
And as we speak, you're hammering away on number 10.
I am.
I mean, that's a long series on one topic. What is it about this that has you so, I don't want to use the word obsessed, but I mean, wow, it's kind of taken over your literary career.
You can use the word obsessed. And it's funny because I had no background whatsoever in the Knights Templar when I first started. I was writing legal thrillers, and we have a local legend in the town that I lived in for over two decades, Westford, Massachusetts, the legend of the Westford Knight, spelled with a K. And that legend is that Scottish explorers, sort of the remnants of the outlawed Knights Templar, came over to New England in the late 1300s, 100 years before Columbus. One of their party died, one of the knights died, and they carved an effigy into the rock ledge to memorialize his death. And so that's the legend we have in my hometown, Western Massachusetts. And I sort of said, one of my daughters came home from school one day, elementary school, with this story. I said, well, that's a fun story. That might be a fun thing to weave into one of my legal thrillers. And I started doing the research on it. I went down that rabbit hole maybe 15 years ago, and I'm still ferreting around in the dusty corners of Templar history a decade and a half later, 9 books later, in desperate need of a shower and a change of clothes. But this turns out that there are so many aspects to this mystery. There are so many things about the Templar Order, because they were a secret order, things we don't know about. I mean, think about having, you know, the United States today and for the past, say, 100 years has been the most powerful country on Earth. Let's say that the United States, everything about it was secret, and historians 600 years from now are trying to figure that out, but it was all secret. Imagine how many mysteries there would be. And that's sort of what it was like with the Templars. They were incredibly powerful, but they were secret. And we don't really know what happened, what they believed, what they did, what got them to become powerful, or what got them to become outlaws. So there's just so much to learn about. And you use the word obsessed, Richard, and I think that's fair. I am, you know, this stuff keeps me up at night.
Well, let's suppose that they did come to America before Columbus. And I think most of us now have slowly come around to the idea that Columbus wasn't first. He was probably last. So if the Templars, the Knights Templars, came to North America in the 1300s, more than 100 years before Columbus, so what? What's the implication here?
Right. Really, there really isn't, it's not that earth-shattering a concept, other than we just have this line in the sand, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Like, it's not that big a deal. We know that the Norse came across, at least as far as maritime Canada, hundreds of years before that. So what would be the big deal if the Templars came? It really wouldn't change that much. The thing that does change history is, why did they come? You know, again, they were outlawed in 1307. It stands to reason that they saw the writing on the wall, and one of the reasons they would have come would have been to create for themselves a safe haven, a place to secrete their treasures and their valuables. And so if they did come, which I think they did, the question then is their treasure still here? Or if not, what happened to it? It's not whether they came or not. It's why did they come? Were they coming for religious reasons, because they believed a version of Christianity which differed from the orthodoxy of the church? And if so, what was that difference? And what does that mean about the church itself? So those are the questions that I think are the really interesting things. Whether they came or not, I mean, who cares? I think they did. I think it would be more surprising if nobody came between the time of Leif Erikson in the early 11th century and Columbus. Like, why wouldn't people come back and forth? It's part of the human condition to, as they say in Star Trek, to seek out new life and new civilization. I mean, it's what humans do. Again, it'd be more surprising if 500 years passed without somebody else crossing the Atlantic. But as I said, the important question, the interesting question, is why were they here and what were they doing?
And if they did find these amazingly important Christian artifacts, the Holy Grail, the Crown of Thorns, the One True Cross, the Spear of Destiny, who knows what else, the Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant, sure.
If they brought those with them, that means they're here somewhere in North America. Are they in Oak Island? Are they buried somewhere in the Ozarks or Washington, D.C., and they're out there waiting to be discovered.
Right, so that's a $64,000 or perhaps $64 million question. Where are they? You know, were they brought over here and then later retrieved and brought back to Europe, and perhaps they're at Roslyn Chapel in Scotland? Were they brought over here and then just lost? Were they treasures and brought over here and liquidated to pay for the American Revolution? I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities, and there's evidence that supports all three of those things I just mentioned, by the way, and it's also possible that we just haven't found them yet. That they're still being that they were hidden, and they're still being hidden and kept hidden by certain groups here, and to be released at some future time. So that's the fourth possibility. And again, but this is fertile ground for fiction, and I think beyond just the fictional interest, I think people who are interested in history have a real fascination with this as well.
Treasure Templari, Templars, Nazis, and the Holy Grail. Again, it's a piece of fiction, but it is deeply rooted in historical fact, and it centers around a medieval painting called the Ghent Altarpiece. Tell me about what this painting looks like.
So the Ghent Altarpiece, it's a huge painting. It's about the size of a barn door, and it's comprised of 16 separate paintings, separate panels. It was painted by the Van Eyck brothers, Hubert and Jan Van Eyck, in the late 1420s, early 1430s. It was quite a spectacle when it was first painted. The Van Eycks came up with a really cutting edge technology to create bright, vibrant colors. I mean, there was colored paint, of course, back then, but they added linseed oil to the pigments to really create a vibrant product. Picture, for example, going from black and white television to high definition color, because that's basically what these guys did, not just with the color, but they painted with such detail. Every single hair on the horse's back you can identify. They really changed the way painting was done. And so when this painting came out, not only was it an important painting for religious purposes, which we'll get to, but just the quality itself was quite a remarkable thing during that time period. NPR recently called it the most important painting in history. And in addition to being important, it's also the most stolen painting in history. It's been stolen 6 or 7 times. But again, it starts back in the early parts of the 1400s in Ghent, a city in Belgium.
And the depiction on one panel in particular is really of primary importance to the story, correct?
Right, and I believe these images are up on the Coast to Coast website if listeners want to take a look. But the central image is something called the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, and what that is essentially is a picture of a lamb, which symbolizes Jesus being pierced with a lance. Everyone knows that story, and the blood flowing from the lamb into a chalice, and everybody's watching, all the important figures in both the Old and the New Testament, the angels, the prophets, everyone's watching this happen. And this is very symbolic, of course, of the Holy Grail. Also watching this from a separate panel are a group of Knights Templar, Knights of Christ on horseback. They're watching, which is strange because this painting was kept in a Catholic cathedral, St. Bavo's Cathedral, and again, the Templars have been outlawed, so you would think that you wouldn't want to have an outlawed group watching your solemn ceremony, but they're there, and that's curious. And then watching the Templars watch this scene are another group of contemporary figures. They're called the Just Judges, and we'll get back to the Just Judges later. They become very important to this story. But essentially, it's a story. The central panel is a story of the lamb bleeding into a chalice. In other words, the blood into the Holy Grail.
And as you mentioned, one of the most stolen paintings in history, the Ghent Altarpiece, and this is somewhat reminiscent of that George Clooney, I think Bill Murray was also in it, called The Monuments Men, where this group of soldiers, their mission was to recover stolen art pieces, priceless art pieces that were stolen by the Nazis during the Second World War.
Exactly. So it's also Matt Damon. I have to give a shout out to my Boston guy. Matt Damon also was in that movie. But yeah, that's a 2014 feature film. And if your listeners are familiar with the movie, that first scene is a scene where the Nazis come in and steal a painting out of a church, and it is the Ghent altarpiece painting. And that's one of the most important things that they stole and then eventually recovered.
All except that centerpiece.
Not the centerpiece. It's the centerpiece was recovered. There's an edge piece to the far left called the Just Judges panel. And so let me get you.
We'll rewind when we come back. But that's also central to this story. Here's Passion Pit. Take a Walk. Rolling Stone magazine named this song the third best of 2012. Right here on Coast to Coast AM. Great to be with you. Richard Serrett here, coming to you from Coast Toronto affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Well, the rise of microchipping is front and center on the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. Are we ready for technology to get under our skin? As implants are growing more common, in fact, more and more employees, it appears, are willing to take a microchip under their skin. And experts are fearing surveillance and exploitation of workers. However, advocates are saying the concerns are irrational. Irrational? I don't know. Ever read Revelation 13, 16? And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save that he had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name? Irrational. Come on, folks. Check out the story again in the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. All right, back to more of my conversation with Dave Brody as we discuss Templar treasure and the Nazis right here on Coast to Coast AM. David Brody stays with us, the author of Treasure Templari, Templars, Nazis, and the Holy Grail. So we were talking about this painting, the Ghent altarpiece, which was really revolutionary, this piece of work by the Van Eyck brothers back in the 1420s. And it's the most stolen painting in history. So it's recovered. Was it recovered after the war by the Allies?
Right, so the Nazis stole the painting after they rolled into Belgium, and then the Allies recovered it at the very end of the war. But hitting the rewind button a little bit, back to 1934, this one particular panel, there was one panel that for some reason people believed was the map to the Holy Grail. It's called the Just Judges panel. That panel was stolen even before the war in 1934. Hitler was obsessed with it. One of the possibilities is that Belgian nationalists, Belgian patriots, stole it fearing that Hitler was going to get his hands on it eventually, and they took it as a preemptive move. But the mystery about this panel is that one panel has never been recovered, even though the other parts of the painting, other 15 panels, have been recovered. That one panel, that map to the Holy Grail, has never been recovered.
So Hitler believed that the Just Judges panel of the Ghent altarpiece would lead him ultimately to uncovering the Templar treasure, which might lead him to the Holy Grail and all of these other Christian artifacts.
Exactly.
And what did Hitler imagine that he could do with these artifacts? I mean, he was an occultist. He hated Christianity. Why did he want the Holy Grail so badly?
He did hate Christianity, but he also recognized the power of these artifacts, the possible power of these artifacts. There were two things he wanted to do, three things actually. One, he wanted to weaponize them. Could he possibly turn, for example, the Spear of Destiny into some kind of weapon using the magic that was associated with it? Secondly, could he monetize the treasure and use it to fund his war efforts? And then thirdly, if Jesus was immortalized by the crown of thorns or the whatever it was, could Hitler himself become immortal? So he really had three different motivations as far as recovering both the Arma Christi, the items of the crucifixion, the cross, the Spear of Destiny, the crown of thorns, and also the Templar treasure itself.
And the Spear of Destiny, or the Spear of Longines, I mean, that artifact pops up now and again throughout history. It has been possessed by emperors, one of the legends is that whoever rode into battle carrying the spear of Longines could not be defeated, correct?
Exactly, and that's one of the reasons why he wanted to recover it. And this goes back to even before the war started. He had sent out expeditions into the Himalayas, up to the Arctic Circle, down to Africa, looking for all these artifacts. And again, as you said, he was an occultist, so he was obsessed with this. As you also said, he did not like Christianity. He believed that Christianity was too weak a religion for the Reich, that this turn the other cheek, this meek will inherit the earth. He didn't believe any of that stuff, but he did recognize the possible power of these artifacts.
And Himmler also wanted to get his hands on the Just Judges panel, but he thought that the map that was sort of encrypted or encoded into this panel led to something else.
Right. He, also an occultist, he was obsessed with the ancient civilization of Atlantis and their technology. So like Hitler, he wanted to weaponize us. He thought the Just Judges panel was a secret map leading to some kind of portal that would lead to the underground Atlantis technology that was buried someplace. And again, he wanted to use this technology to win the war. So both of them were sort of doing a tug of war over this potential map for different reasons, but the same goal. The goal, again, world dominance.
Now, why would they come to such completely polar opposite conclusions about what this panel of the Ghent Altarpiece was leading to? Why, on the one hand, we have the Holy Grail, and on the other hand, the treasures of Atlantis? I mean, what was it about the Just Judges panel that could lead to such opposite conclusions?
Right, and that's one of the mysteries. I mean, it's hard to get inside the head of these Nazi leaders. They were a little bit off the wall, obviously, so it's hard to be rational, to give rational answers to what they believed. The short answer is that this whole Knights Templar, the mystery of the Templars, and the possibility that the Templars had the Holy Grail. I mean, that was something that has been carried forward ever since they were outlawed in 1307. And that's, you know, we still see that today. But this idea that there's this treasure out there, this unknown treasure, this magical cachet of religious artifacts of some kind, I mean, it's very seductive. And when you couple that with the power that the Nazis had and the power they were trying to acquire, you just end up with these crazy ideas that, oh, if we could only get that, we could win the war. We would have the world dominance that should be ours.
And you allude to in the book, and I don't know if this is a piece of fiction or whether this also is rooted in history, but Hitler got wind that the Just Judges panel might still be in Belgium, and he dispatched one of his evil minions there to recover it. And what happened to him?
Right. When he failed to recover it, he knew that Hitler was not going to be, you know, sympathetic to his failure, and so he committed suicide.
And did that actually happen?
Knowing that was a better fate than Hitler would give him. But that just shows how obsessed Hitler was with finding these items, finding this map that he believed it was, the Just Judges panel.
And so that actually did happen.
That did happen, yes.
And in your book, in this piece of fiction, the Just Judges panel is actually recovered, and so the main protagonists in the story, Cameron and Amanda, they're sort of hired, I guess, to try and decipher the code in this panel that leads to the Templar treasure, and that leads them, you know, hither and yon all over the world, and finally North America.
So what I try to do with these novels is take actual sites and actual artifacts and weave them into a story. One of the things I use, one of the ingredients I use in this story, is a journal from it's dated 1179. It was found in war-torn Italy after World War II. We call this document the Cremona document, this journal, the Cremona document. We're not quite sure if it's authentic or not. Many researchers believe it is. But what it is it's a journal written by a Templar soldier from the year 1179, 1180, talking about a journey across the North Atlantic and ending up in what we now know as the Catskill Mountains of New York. And what that journey entailed was bringing treasures that the Templars had recovered in Jerusalem over to New York, over to the New World, to hide them, to keep them away from the church and other enemies, and then bringing some things back to Europe that had been brought over earlier. So in my story, one of the places that the protagonists go looking for this Templar treasure is the Catskill region of New York.
Now, let me just circle back to the Van Eyck brothers who painted the Ghent altarpiece. And this was in the 1420s. So this is over 100 years after the Knights Templar organization had been banned and hunted down and perhaps expelled from Europe. So were the Van Eycks secretly harboring Knights Templar? What was their connection?
Right. So just as, when the U.S. government passed anti-racketeering laws in the 1960s, which effectively outlawed the mafia didn't go away. They went underground. So similarly, when the church and the monarchies of Europe outlawed the Knights Templar in 1307 going forward, the Templars didn't disappear. They just went underground. They reconstituted themselves. Many of them ended up going to Scotland, which is one of the few countries at the time which did not outlaw them. And so we have to think of it in that context, that the Templars didn't disappear. They went underground and, as I said, reconstituted themselves. Flash forward to the early 1400s, 100 years later, and there are still many groups that were doing the same things the Templars were doing. When I say doing them, I'm talking about studying the old mystery schools, mysticism, and the things that the Knights Templars passed on to Freemasonry today. One of the leading members of that circle was a gentleman by the name of the Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Good. He was called the Duke, but actually he was the king of the lands we now know as Belgium, the Netherlands, and northern France. He was an incredibly powerful monarch during that time period, but he was obsessed himself with the Holy Grail legend, with the stories of the Templars, with mysticism, with alchemy, and it turns out he was the patron of Jan van Eyck. And it was he that commissioned this painting in Belgium, and I think he's sort of the linchpin. He is the tie-in back to the Templar tradition, going backwards to before they were outlawed, and then going forward through the 15th century and even going forward beyond that. But it's people like him. He created his own order called the Order of the Golden Fleece, which, again, another secret order that studied the Holy Grail and alchemy and all this. These mystery schools, we see them recurring frequently throughout history, but it's these kinds of groups that were obsessed with the Holy Grail.
And is there any evidence that Hitler, Himmler, the Nazis suspected that the Templar treasure, including the Arma Christi, these artifacts associated with Christ's crucifixion, that they wound up in North America?
There's no evidence that Hitler and Himmler believed that. They looked all around for them. One of the places they did not look was North America. Now, having said that, it's not like they had access to North America at that time. So we don't really know, what they knew or what they suspected. One of the fascinating things that I learned even after writing the book was that Himmler had these crystal skulls, a white crystal skull and a black crystal skull, that he also believed had magical powers and might lead him to the Holy Grail. And there are similar kinds of skulls that are part of the Native American legend. So although Hitler, we don't have evidence, was looking towards North America, it may have been that Himmler was. There's other evidence that he was doing some work in Central and South America also. So again, we have hints of these things, but no hard evidence.
And in the book, in the fictionalized version of this remarkable story, we have another group that is in modern times that is also hunting for this treasure, and these are the neo-Nazis that exist in small numbers, but they're out there. Mm-hmm. in America. They're also looking to get their hands on the Arma Christi, right?
Right. So again, this is a fictional thing, but as you said, there are neo-Nazi groups out there still today. This particular group, one of the interesting little twists is they pick up where Himmler left off. It was really Himmler who, as much as Hitler didn't have any use for Christianity, it was Himmler who really took it to the next step and really wanted to reintroduce the old gods, the old Norse gods, Thor, for example, the old pagan gods. And he, in the SS, he would encourage his soldiers to celebrate the old pagan celebrations, for example, the cross-quarter days, dancing around the Maypole at Beltane, those kinds of things. And so my neo-Nazi groups have sort of picked that up. I don't think people realize that Himmler was a real pagan celebrant. That was one of the things he was really promoting, was a return to these old agrarian pagan celebrations, the cross-quarter days, the equinoxes, the solstices. It was an interesting part of the research that I didn't know about until I started diving into this story.
And getting back to the Holy Grail, has your research led you to any conclusions or, I don't know, suppositions about what the actual Grail might be? Is it a chalice? Is it some sort of a record of, well, some people believe that Christ married Mary Magdalene and they had children, etc., and that's what the Grail is. It's kind of a list of his progeny.
So my personal opinion, and this comes from that 1179 travelogue that I mentioned earlier, one of the things that in the travelogue it says that the Templars retrieved in the Catskills, things that had been brought over earlier and they were coming over to retrieve them, was a scroll that contained the marriage contract between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Now, if such a marriage contract were to exist, obviously that'd be incredibly important historically, also fairly controversial and explosive. But that may be the thing that the Templars discovered when they were in Jerusalem in the early 12th century, that they leveraged into a position of power against the church. It's not the type of thing the church would want to come out. So your comment that potential of the Holy Grail being this progeny of Jesus, I think that marriage contract is consistent with that theory. That's a very possible scenario, and I would say the leading contender as to what the Holy Grail is.
All right, David, we're going to open up the phone lines and at the next hour take questions and comments. If you're interested in the Knights Templar, I mean, who isn't? And the Templar treasure and artifacts of Christ's crucifixion, the Holy Grail, the Spear of Destiny, the Crown of Thorns, the one true cross. Could they be located in Oak Island, for example, off the coast of Nova Scotia? Are they somewhere perhaps in the Washington, D.C. area, those familiar with the movie National Treasure? We'll do that on the other side.